He arrows into it. Every time he fires an arrow, he looks away because he's very affectionate towards Bhishma. And Bhishma is just smiling, accepting the arrows. It's a very touching scene. Arjuna is almost crying, shooting these arrows. And Bhishma is shooting arrows at Krishna. I don't know if this is in the film, but this is in the description of Mahabharata. He's shooting arrows. And because they're in this very esoteric rasa, the chivalrous rasa, Krishna is feeling these as flowers landing on him. And the Goswamis have commented on how he had this feeling of what these arrows felt like. And one commentary says that he felt them like the bites of a lover. Sometimes a lover bites the skin, or sometimes in kissing there's very hard pressure on the teeth. It's very painful. But in the sexual embrace, they don't feel it as pain, they feel it as pleasure. So in this way, Krishna was feeling these arrows in this rasa of chivalry as very pleasing and very satisfying. Anyway, what Bhishma had promised Duryodhana that he would fight in such a fierce way that he would either kill Arjuna. He said, "I'll kill him," and if he didn't kill him, he would force Krishna, because he was his intimate friend, to break his promise and engage in fighting. That was his determination to Duryodhana. Either kill him, or I'll fight so fiercely the Supreme Personality of Godhead has to break his word. His solemn word will have to be broken. So this appeared to happen, because he said he wasn't going to fight, and suddenly he had the most devastating weapon in the whole creation, the chakra in the form of this chariot. He was spinning it and running after him. So, and Krishna is described as being very beautiful in that scene, with the blood that had splashed in his body and the dust from the battle. But as I recall in the Mahabharata, because the Kshatriya codes they couldn't fight in the evening, that this time the sun began to set. So Krishna had to withdraw. So in one sense, he broke his promise to fight, but he didn't actually break it, because he didn't actually fight. He just started to fight. So it was one of those situations where Krishna can reconcile all differences and break and not break his promise and satisfy everybody. So these are some of the ways in which Krishna very mysteriously works. He operates from another dimension and in a way that is completely mysterious and mystifying the conditioned souls. He operates. It doesn't even really operate, but his agents operate for him. Like Vishnu, they maintain the material world. And like Lord Brahma, they create the material world. And like Lord Shiva, destroying the material world. And Krishna, in his original form, he's never one step out of Vrindavan. He's simply sporting and enjoying. This is the great mystic potency of the Supreme Lord. So, I'll stop here. If you have any comments or questions, we don't have too much time. Yes. Rajhari, Rajabihari. Welcome to United States. Hastinapura, new Hastinapura Dham.
You were saying how the material world is like a reform school. And that the suffering that the conditioned soul goes through is ultimately a benefit. So we see, especially in the West, not as much in India, but especially in the West, that when people see a lot of suffering in the world, it seems to increase their debts about the existence of God rather than...
increase their debts?
Debts.
Doubts.
Rather than increase their fire.
Yeah.
Could you clear up that?
Yeah. Sometimes Prabhupada made a distinction between being demonic and being unfortunate. We were riding in a car with him once in London, and there was a traffic policeman. Was in a lady. And he said, "What is this? They're having lady policemen?" And he had never seen this before. It's in London. So this isn't exactly 100% related to your question, but he was very amused by it. He said, "What if some very strong rogue grabs her? How will she defend herself?" He was, seeing all women as his mother like that. Anyway, someone said, "Well, Prabhupada, she's a policewoman. She has a dress." They said, "So, and if someone tears the dress off, then what?" Anyway, right in that car at that time, this conversation came up, and he was saying that there are so many unfortunate people here in this world, here in this city in London, They're so unfortunate, some of them may never become devotees. And we were saying, "What, Prabhupada, what do you mean?" And he said, "Can't we reform the demons?" And he said, "Yes, demons, they can be reformed, but fortunate is a lower position. They cannot be reformed." So then the discussion came up at some point, like, about people who had come in and lived in the temple even, and entered in some form of devotional service, and even lived like devotees, but then one day they somehow went completely insane and ended up living in an institution. So the idea was that there is such a thing as misfortune or unfortunate. And the most unfortunate thing is that one cannot become a devotee, even after being exposed in some way to either the material world and all of its miseries, or even to devotional service. Whereas one who is demonic, and I guess we can all say we were demonic, or eating meat at least at some time, we were fortunate because we were reformed. We were able to get that mercy, get that little ray of Vishnu or Krishna, that book or that devotee, that prasadam or whatever it was, heard the Hari Nam Mahamantra, heard the holy name, that saved us. It was the lifeline that brought us out of unfortunate to becoming fortunate, or out of demonic. But there's apparently a level which is very difficult to come out of. And therefore we see a lot of conditioned souls, like you mentioned, this part of the world, they seem to be just recycling themselves. As the Bhagavad Gita mentions, they're cast again and again into demonic wombs, and they can't seem to get that lifeline, even though we're reaching out to them regularly. So this is the unfortunate condition of the jail. The metaphor of the prison house is used because some people don't seem to get out of it. They just seem to like it, or they become more deeper enmeshed in ignorance. So we have our prison outreach programs, because there seems to be no exit for people. They just become involved in this endless cycle of misery. And some may just be so unfortunate we don't see any sort of light at the end of the tunnel. So Brahmanda Brahmite Konyu Bhagyavanji Guru Krishna Prasade Paya Bhaktalita Vij, that the living entity is in this condition of just going from one material world to another, being bewildered. And I don't know which word means fortunate in that verse, but if he is very fortunate, then, huh? Bhagyavan. Bhagyavan, yeah, Bhagyavan means fortunate. If he is fortunate, then through this lifeline of either devotee or whatever it may be, somehow Krishna sends that person. Or it's also the inconceivable or causeless mercy. We call it causeless mercy. We don't know why some people get it and some people don't. But then he becomes fortunate, and he gets the seed of devotional service that's planted in that person's mind. It's a very difficult thing to understand. It almost appears that that there's injustice, and the higher system, the infallible so-called justice system of karma and reaction and action and transmigration, seems to be mysterious and to us. Plus, on the other hand, we do accept that there is such a thing as universal justice. And one time Prabhupada was asked, what about people in a plane crash? There seems so many innocent people, children in the airplane, 300 people die all of a sudden. Prabhupada said, this is arranged by material nature. These people have all been assembled in this place so that they will meet that particular karmic reaction at that all at one time. It's very difficult, very mysterious to understand. What's that?
So, just like you don't see how the misery of a particular person is mitigated, even by contact, as you say, some people come in contact with come into the temple for some time and go crazy. Similarly, we don't see what happens at the time of death. So even somebody who we consider to be completely out of it may, at the time of death, see Krishna's mercy. Just like, whose mother was that who asked at the time of death, is there Krishna here now? I mean, she ostensibly was not a devotee. So you can tell from that question that she received the mercy at that point. There's so many millions of people, just like they're seeing like that, but there's a common time in mind said one time. And it reminded us that the mind is just like a movie camera. It's taking every single scene that you see. And at the time of death, it's all gets replayed. So if someone sees Lojana from the park, it's like the strangest thing you've seen in your whole life. In the moment of death, and the whole life is being replayed. You may just lock onto that one strange thing that you've never seen in New York or in Paris or London or wherever. So we can't tell how many countless millions of people at the time of death, even when they seem completely unfortunate in their whole life. If they just saw Lojana once, they can lock onto that at the moment of death and
That's a good point. We don't know the karmic background of any individual either. What's the verse in the 11th count? We should try to see all the living entities as our own brethren, our sons, our children, because one of them might be my spiritual master one day. We don't know. We don't know what their background is. Like you say, it's invisible. Yeah?
Regarding the sambal of the scroll
and the
tree, this year in the TV, you see resolutions also. The controversy was put to an end. But actually, the Srila Prabhupada did establish that originally the soul does originate from the spiritual world. And it's not just that we come out of karmic yogi. And Prabhupada mentioned also in that letter to Manavisa that there may be some controversy, you know, whether we come from there. Prabhupada said, you're not a leader, you're not in leader in Brahman, nor are you in Krishna Leela. But ultimately, beyond this whole discussion, we originally Prabhupada said we come from. We have been in Krishna Leela. And we have fallen into this material world.
Yeah, well, it wasn't exactly quite like that. It's still, there's still certain elements of that are, it's not just totally cut and dried. There's still some elements of discussion going on. You know? Okay, so I think we'll stop here. Thank you very much. Hare Krishna. Vishwaratamana Mohan Ki Jai. Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai. Pantara Srimad Bhagavatam Ki Jai.
Jai Om Vishnupad Paramahansa Paribrajagacharya Stotarasata Shishi Manasavangre Srila Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur Maharaj Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai Ananta Koti Vaishnavarinda Ki Jai ISKCON Founder Acharya Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai Namacharya Srila Haridas Thakur Ki Jai Prem Zagho Sri Krishna Chaitana Prabhu Nityananda Sri Adhara Gadara Srivasadi Gaur Bhakta Vrinda Ki Jai Sri Sri Radha Krishna Gopi Gopinath Sham Kundarara Kundagiri Govardhan Ki Jai Shri Shri Vrindavan Dham Ki Jai, Shri Jinarup Dham Ki Jai, Shri Shri Mayapur Dham Ki Jai, Shri Shri Jagannath Puri Dham Ki Jai, Shri Shri Mathura Dham Ki Jai, Shri Shri Ayodhya Dham Ki Jai, Tulasi Devi Ki Jai, Bhakti Devi Ki Jai, Ganga Maya Ki Jai, Gaur Premanandi, Harinam Sankirtan Ki Jai, Shri Shri Brihad Mridanga Ki Jai, Transcendental Prasadam Distribution Ki Jai, Shri Shri Gauranitai Ki Jai, Shri Shri Sitaram Lakshman Hanuman Ki Jai, Shri Shri Radha Madana Mohana Ki Jai, Shri Shri Nu Hastinapura Dhamma Ki Jai, Shyamabeta Bhaktavrinda Ki Jai, all glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to Shri Shri Guru and Shri Gauranga. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Narayanam Namaskritam Naram Chaivam Narottamam Devim Sarasvatim Vyasam Dato Jayamudirayat Nasta Prayeshu Abhadreshu Nityam Bhagavata Sevaya Bhagavati Uttama Shloke Bhakti Bhavati Naishtiki. We're reading from the Srimad Bhagavatam, translations and purports by His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Srila Prabhupada. Third canto, 20th chapter, text 10, is it? 10, 11's on the board?
No, 12.
12. So should I read? I'll just read then, 10 and 11. Ye marichyadayo vipra yastu swayam bhuvo manaha tevai brahmana adeshat kotam etad abhavayan. That's text number 10. Vidura inquired, how did the Prajapatis, such progenitors of living entities as Marichi and Swayambhuva Manu, create according to the instruction of Brahma, and how did they evolve this manifested universe? And 11. Svaditiya kimasrijan svatantra udakarmasu ahosvit samhata sarva idam sma samakalpayan. Did they evolve the creation in conjunction with their respective wives? Did they remain independent in their action? Or did they all jointly produce it? Text 12. Maitreya uvacha daivena durvitarkyena parena nimishena cha jata shobhad bhagavato mahan asid gunatrayat maitreya uvacha daivena durvitarkyena daivena turvitakena kena parena nimishena cha parena nimishena cha jata shobhad bhagavato jata shobhad bhagavato mahanasid gunatrayat mahanasid gunatrayat Maitreya uvacha daivena durvitarkyena parena nimishena cha jata shobhad bhagavato
Mahanasid Gunatraya Maitreya Uvacha Daivena Durvitarkyena Parena Nimishena Cha Jatakshobhad Bhagavato Mahanasid Gunatraya. Maitreya Uvacha. Maitreya said, Daivena, by superior management, known as destiny. Durvitarkyena, beyond empiric speculation. Patrena, aparena, by Mahavishnu. Animishena, by the potency of eternal time. Cha, and Jatakshobhat, the equilibrium was agitated. Bhagavata, of the personality of Godhead. Mahan, the total material elements. The Mahatattva. Asit were produced. Gunatraya from the three modes of nature. Maitreya said, when the equilibrium of the combination of the three modes of nature was agitated by the unseen activity of the living entity, the Mahavishnu, and by the force of time, the total material elements were produced. Responsively. Maitreya said,
when the equilibrium of the combination
of the three modes of nature was agitated by the unseen activity of the living entity by Mahavishnu and by the force of time, the total material elements were produced. Purport, Srila Prabhupada. The cause of the material creation is described here very lucidly. The first cause is Daiva, or the destiny of the conditioned soul. The material creation exists for the conditioned soul who wanted to become a false lord for sense enjoyment. One cannot trace out the history of when the conditioned soul first desired to lord it over material nature. But in Vedic literature, we always find that the material creation is meant for the sense enjoyment of the conditioned soul. There is a nice verse which says that the sum and substance of the conditioned soul's sense enjoyment is that as soon as he forgets his primary duty to render service to the Lord, he creates an atmosphere of sense enjoyment, which is called Maya. That is the cause of material creation. Another word used here is Dvitarkyena. No one can argue about when and how the conditioned soul became desirous of sense enjoyment, but the cause is there. Material nature is an atmosphere meant only for the sense enjoyment of the conditioned soul, and it is created by the personality of Godhead. It is mentioned here that in the beginning of the creation, the material nature, or Prakriti, is agitated by the personality of Godhead, Vishnu. There are three Vishnus mentioned. One is Mahavishnu, another is Garbhodakshayi Vishnu, and the third is Shirodakshayi Vishnu. The first canto of the Srimad Bhagavatam discusses all these three Vishnus, and here also it is confirmed that Vishnu is the cause of creation. From Bhagavad Gita also we learn that Prakriti begins to work and is still working under Krishna's or Vishnu's glance of superintendence. But the Supreme Personality of Godhead is unchangeable. One should not mistakenly think that because the creation emanates from the Supreme Personality of Godhead, he has therefore transformed into this cosmic manifestation. He exists in his personal form always, but the cosmic manifestation takes place by his inconceivable potency. The workings of that energy are difficult to comprehend, but it is understood from the Vedic literature that the conditioned soul creates its own destiny and is offered a particular body by the laws of nature under the superintendence of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, who always accompanies him as Paramatma.
Stapitam yena bhutale svayam rupa kadamayam tadati svaparantikam.
Prabhupada mentions that one cannot trace out the history of when the conditioned soul first desired to lord it over material nature. So once Prabhupada was commenting on this, and the question came up of Nityabhata and Nityasiddha living entities. And I asked him, how can there be Nityabhata and Nityasiddha? If we're Nityabhata, or eternally conditioned, where was the beginning? Or if we're Nityasiddha, how did that start? So Prabhupada gave kind of a simple answer. He said that eternally conditioned means that we can't understand how far back this conditioning goes. So I said, does that mean we can't think about it? And he said, if we could understand it, there would be no meaning to eternity. So I didn't pursue it very much further because I thought this is a pretty deep subject. I better think about this some more. And I did think about it some more. And I remembered when I was back in high school, I read a book by a mathematician called George Gamow. And the book was called 1, 2, 3 Infinity. It was about the nature of infinity. And in the book, he described how certain peoples who live in very primitive fashions don't have very advanced systems of communication and language and numbering. And numbers over 10 or 15 are, to them, infinity. Just like we can't imagine. Really, we can see 10 objects. We can imagine what 50 objects look like. And we can maybe imagine sort of what 1,000 look like. But when we get into 1,000,000, 10 or 20 billion objects of any size, it really can't imagine what they look like. So that for us is infinity, even though from a technical mathematical standpoint it's not exactly infinity in the sense of an unlimited number. But our understanding is limited because we simply can't think that deeply or that far ahead. Whereas more advanced beings in the universe, like Lord Brahma, their minds can comprehend such space and such distances. And they can actually understand such things as higher dimensional space and things that are beyond our ordinary perception. Sesh was talking about at Hokshaja yesterday. Shri Ramana Mohan Kijai. Things that are beyond perception. This is the way that we approach spiritual life, that everything comes from a higher sense, a higher thought process, sometimes called the fourth dimension. And that's a dimension which, in our three-dimensional thinking, we can't understand. Or in higher dimensional, we can't understand, like Prapti Siddhi, for example. It's just a material form of a higher dimension. But as Prabhupada writes in the Nectar of Devotion, there are yogis who have developed this power of Prapti, and they can produce or reach to another part, like for example, if they're in India, they can reach to Afghanistan, he said, and procure a pomegranate. So it's not that we think that this yogi has an arm that's 3,000 miles long and he reaches through space and picks a pomegranate off a tree in Afghanistan, but it's something different. It's a different conception of space, or the way in which different arms of Vishnu are all moving, like three or four arms, two arms from one shoulder. It doesn't compute with our conception of three-dimensional space unless they can move through each other somehow. And the same with the different heads of Brahma and Shiva, sometimes thousands, sometimes millions of heads, they're all attached onto one neck and one body. That's not accommodated by our conception of three-dimensional space. So it's very difficult to comprehend what actually the spiritual world is if we try to understand it if we try to analyze it or perceive it through the eyes of our senses and our mental power, which is very limited. So similarly, it's difficult to understand infinity or very large numbers. And as Prabhupada is indicating, one can't trace out when this took place, when the conditioned soul somehow exercised when and how his independence, his material independence. Another time Prabhupada was asked this question about when did it begin. He gave an example of someone who was shot by an arrow. And he said the immediate thing is to remove that arrow from the body, not to try to ascertain where it came from. And there was also the example of the crow and tall fruit logic. I think this was in a letter he wrote to Madhavisa. He said something, it was something like this. There were three wise men sitting under a tree, very intelligent sages, and a crow came onto this tall fruit tree. As it landed, the tall fruit appeared to drop right in front of the sages. So the first one said, oh, very interesting. The crow landed on the branch, and by the force of its landing, this tall fruit fell down. And said, no, that's not what happened at all. The crow had already landed. Then the fruit fell down and it scared him, it flew away. So the third one said, no, that's not right at all. What happened was they both happened exactly simultaneously at the same time, and therefore we don't know whether the crow caused the fruit to fall or the fruit caused the crow to fly away. So they began to argue back and forth, and each one was thoroughly convinced that he was right. And they went on and on, very intelligent sages, and finally someone came along and picked it up and offered it to Krishna and ate it. So that the moral of that was that there's a limitation to how much one can ascertain with one's own brain, and the immediate need is to engage in some form of devotional service. That's the need, the crying need of the conditioned soul. So the idea was just a little warning that one shouldn't unnecessarily debate to the point where devotional service is forgotten. However, in our Sampradaya, there are sometimes very vigorous and necessary debates between Vaishnavas to ascertain what the absolute truth is, and Prabhupada encouraged this. He would sometimes throw out a premise and he would say, okay, now you argue about this. There is no God. I was in his room once with another devotee and he said, okay, now prove to me that there is God. And he had me engage in an argument with another devotee in front of him. So Prabhupada was encouraged, vigorous debate. It has its place, and the purpose of it is smaranam. If one is engaged in kirtanam, shravanam kirtanam, then one will be able to increase one's smaranam, hearing and reading, chanting, hearing and then speaking, or reading and then speaking, and then by speaking we remember more. This happened to me the other day. I was on the phone, and sometimes in this country they conduct radio interviews on the telephone. Very convenient because you don't have to go down to the studio. You can just sit there and you can have all your papers in front of you, and you can. This is in relation to the Divine Nature book, which Judah Karma and I wrote. So I found it was a certain element of remembrance was taking place. I found myself saying things that I didn't ordinarily say, or don't remember even thinking so much, but maybe I read a long time ago. So this is proof. I mean, it happens all the time. The more one engages in the process of preaching, repeating or discussing what one has heard from others or what one's read in Prabhupada's books, the more easy it is to remember. This takes place even in the mundane world. I remember when I was in college, this was a school that people thought was academically unusually advanced, although there were a lot of so-called eccentric people who went to this school. They had beards and they did somewhat strange things. But the atmosphere was to discuss what you learned instead of drinking beer and going to parties. They did that, their share of that. But they a lot of them like to just sit around and discuss what was in the books to create an intellectual sort of atmosphere. And it was very good in terms of trying to remember what was going on. In fact, there was one student at this school who was particularly gifted. He had some strange characteristics too, but he was a mathematician. He was so talented that he read all the textbooks, and in the first 6 months he was there, he began to rewrite them, and he started seminars and began to lecture to the mathematics faculty. He also had some very strange personal habits. He used to climb up in trees and sit there all day and read his mathematics books. One day he scaled a 10-story building in the city, and this is a little strange thing, but there was a there. Anyway, I better not tell. So there was an atmosphere there, intellectual atmosphere, that people would sit with the teachers, they would discuss, and they would discuss among themselves. So Prabhupada encouraged this. In the material world, this discussion, these questions is going on also, but they're not for the ultimate benefit of the human being. As Prabhupada said once, everybody's asking questions and getting answers. Even the birds, we can hear them in the morning. Or the peacocks, you hear them in the evening. They're great sages, possibly, and maybe they are discussing transcendental topics. But we can see the animals, the birds, the insects, they're always making sounds and talking to each other. So the sounds of the conditioned souls are really no different than the animals, that they're not saying anything that takes them out of that category of the mode of tama, the mode of ignorance, and the mode of being subjected helplessly to the laws of nature. Whereas topics that are in relation to the Supreme Personality of Godhead are rejuvenating, they're ever new, they're refreshing, they're stimulating, and they cause us to deepen our devotion to Krishna. They cause us to become more devotional. So the material world, someone might ask, well, why are we here in this prison house? Why do we create it if it just keeps us locked in here and discussing mundane topics and becoming more and more immersed in the material world? So there was one thing that Prabhupada used to say about that. He used to give the example of people who went to church during the war, especially the ladies, praying for their husbands and sons and brothers and fathers to come back from the war in Europe, World War II. Then after the war was over, whether their fathers, sons, brothers, or sons came back or not, most of them went out of the church and either they became atheists or a few of them maybe became a little bit more devotional. So I found this, it was a Hindi poet that Prabhupada quoted. I finally found it the other day. I was reading in the ninth canto. The verse is, Dukha se sabha hari bhaje, sukha se bhaje koi, sukha se agar hari bhaje, dukha katan se haya. And Prabhupada paraphrases the translation like this. When one is distressed, he goes to the church or temple to worship the Lord. But when opulent, he forgets the Lord. Therefore, punishment by the Lord through material nature is necessary in human society. For without it, men forget the supremacy of the Lord due to their dull, blunt intelligence. So, in that sense, we can see the material world is kind of like a reform school. And that's, even though it's the place of misuse of independence, it's like a jail. A jail is actually meant to reform people. When I was young, there was talk of reform school. That was the jail for us if we were juvenile delinquents. We went to it wasn't a jail, but it was reform. It was a reform if you were young. It was jail if you were old. But the idea is to deter crime and to change. Of course, we know that most of the institutions in this material world, they don't reform people really. Some do, and some fortunate people take advantage of these jails and they become reformed. They maybe even turn to God. But the whole idea of the material world is this element of pain, so that one can, like the conditioned soul in the womb, pray that I won't commit sin anymore. I won't do anything violent or abusive or against the law. I won't be an outlaw. And then I'll come out a respectful citizen, a respectable citizen. That part of the material world is good. And, of course, Queen Kunti prays for difficulty, for trouble. And that janmai shraya shuta shivir edak mana manak puman naivar hatya vidan tumbai tamakinshana gochara. That prayer is that if one is very opulent, wealthy, and is on the path of material progress, trying to improve himself by higher education, by noble birth, by bodily beauty, by opulence, janmaishvarya shruta shribir, by great intelligence, then one will be conditioned and one will not be able to utter the Supreme Lord's name with great feeling. There's a quality, Prabhupada writes in the purport of that, there's quality to the utterance of Krishna's name, the Hare Krishna mantra. So she says that it is very easy, my Lord, you are very easy to approach by chanting your holy name, but only by those who are materially exhausted. Dhamma kinchana gotra. So the material world is meant for us to see that there is no actual end to it, that one tries to enjoy and then becomes materially exhausted. And then one turns to Krishna. Actually, this was Rajneesh's philosophy. His philosophy was that you have to enjoy everything to the maximum. Whatever it takes, you just go on enjoying and enjoying and enjoying. And then eventually, by enjoying everything, you will become pure. That was the way it went. But this was like a school or a university that you never graduate from, because there was never a degree given. There was never a goal. There was never an end. It was just, you just go on enjoying and enjoying, and then sooner or later, somehow, you'll become purified and you'll become spiritual. Of course, nobody ever came spiritual. Nobody ever became, because there was no spiritual practice. It was just ordinary practice. When I was in Holland once, I don't know why we did it, but I think they, Rajneesh people, invited us to go there. And they were telling us that now they had adopted this technique that everyone who went through their doors, who came to live there, was like a little hotel. They had to have AIDS tests. Anyway, that chapter seems to have come to a close. So as Prabhupada mentions in the purport, the conditioned souls, they create the material energy. And by their different desires, they create different situations. And as we were discussing yesterday, this is the opposite of Krishna. Krishna is always creating his own appearance by his own desire. And he's appearing somewhere, always somewhere. In these material worlds, he's always in the spiritual world. And he has many different forms. Janma karma chamedi vyam. And it's said that anyone who can understand how he appears, the nature of his appearance and qualities, that person is complete in his understanding. It doesn't take birth again, in this material world. But the conditioned soul is different. And as it's mentioned in Bhagavad Gita, Karanam Laguna Sangasya, he follows his way and enjoys modes of nature according to his own way. This is due to his association with material nature, and thus he meets good and bad in various species. Now, Krishna also appears in different species. And one purport said he appears in all species. This is another completely inconceivable statement that Prabhupada made once. I just wanted to read briefly from the purport to that verse in the 13th chapter, 22nd verse of Bhagavad Gita, Purusha Prakritasto Hi Karnaguna Sangasya. Prabhupada says, this verse is very important for an understanding of how the living entities transmigrate from one body to another. It is explained in the second chapter that the living entity is transmigrating from one body to another just as one changes dress. This change of dress is due to his attachment to material existence. As long as he is captivated by this false manifestation, he has to continue transmigrating from one body to another. Due to his desire to lord it over material nature, he is put into such undesirable circumstances. Under the influence of material desire, the entity is born sometimes as a demigod, sometimes as a man, sometimes as a beast, as a bird, as a worm, as an aquatic, as a saintly man, as a bug. This is going on, and in all cases, the living entity thinks himself to be the master of his circumstances, yet he is under the influence of material nature. How he is put into such different bodies is explained here. It is due to association with the different modes of nature. One has to rise, therefore, above the three material modes and become situated in the transcendental position. That is called Krishna consciousness. Unless one is situated in Krishna consciousness, his material consciousness will oblige him to transfer from one body to another because he has material desires since time immemorial. But he has to change that conception. That change can be effected only by hearing from authoritative sources. The best example is here. Arjuna is hearing the science of God from Krishna. The living entity, if he submits to this hearing process, will lose his long-cherished desire to dominate material nature. And gradually and proportionally, as he reduces his long desire to dominate, he comes to enjoy spiritual happiness. In a Vedic mantra, it is said that he becomes learned in association with the Supreme Personality of Godhead. He proportionally relishes his eternal bliss. And this is one of the points we were describing in the book on the environment, divine nature. This tendency to dominate. And when we were being interviewed, they wanted to know, well, what would you recommend? How can we do anything? So before we told them to, we thought that one should enjoy non-material sources of pleasure, such as chanting Hare Krishna mantra. We would say things like, well, the first thing you should do is stop eating meat, because that's very degrading and debilitating to the whole environment. We run through all the statistics about how much water it takes to raise one animal for slaughter, how much petrol is used in the animal factories, how all the manure that's in concentration in the feedlots is polluting the water streams and water underground, water table, so on and so on and so on. And then gradually we lead up to sources of non-material satisfaction, such as meditation, such as yoga, mantras, and then gradually explain that one can get great inner peace and satisfaction from chanting the holy names of the Lord. It's done all over the world in different languages, in different ways, different songs. And then sometimes we'll chant a little so they can hear how beautiful the mantra is and some melody or something like that. So this is the transcendental dimension. And as Arjuna heard, he heard with an open mind, he heard that from Krishna's spiritual master in this case, who knew all the things he didn't know, and he became a submissive hearer. And this reminded me when I was reading this verse, how, of course, Krishna, we know, is omniscient, but there was one story Prabhupada told about how Krishna knows everything. It's from the Mahabharata, but Prabhupada was recounting it in the lecture. That one time during the Battle of Kurukshetra, Bhishma had fashioned as a great warrior and grandsire of the clan, the Pandavas, five arrows that were specially equipped so they would kill the five Pandavas, but he didn't use them. And at one time, Duryodhana had given Arjuna a boon. The Kshatriya spirit was, if you make a promise to someone, you could never break it. So Arjuna said, okay, he said, I'm going to give you a boon. That boon is that you can do, you can ask me anything you want and I'll give it to you. So as some of these great personalities in the past have done, he deferred it to a later date. He said, all right, I'll tell you, whenever time is appropriate, I'll let you know. So during the fighting, Duryodhana perceived that Bhishma was not fighting with full strength and vigor because he had great affection for the Pandavas. And so he complained to him. He said, you're not really fighting like a true Kshatriya. And because he was a Kshatriya, he took this as a great personal insult. Again, the Kshatriya spirit. You have to fight with great vigor. So he said, I want you to... So then he told him, I have these five arrows. And now that you've challenged me, I feel sufficiently fired up. That wasn't the word Prabhupada used. To kill the Pandavas. In fact, I've got these arrows that are specially... equip them to kill them. So I will use them tomorrow and it will finish them off. So Duryodhana said, all right. He said, but let me have the arrows. Let me just, for safekeeping, I'll have them till tomorrow, overnight. Because being a very clever politician and being aware of Krishna's various, what he called tricks, chicanery, he thought, just in case one of these Pandavas or somebody comes to Bhishma to get the arrows, I'll have them and hid them away. So he hid them away, and of course Krishna, being omniscient, knew exactly what was taking place. So Krishna advised him, and because Krishna could see everything that was happening, and he was advising from a distance, he called Arjuna to his camp. Now he had promised both Duryodhana and Arjuna that he wouldn't fight. That was the deal. He would be there. He'd be the chariot driver, but he absolutely wouldn't. That was his promise. It was ironclad promise. I will not take up weapons. I will not fight. So, he was always giving hints and advising how to make this formation, that formation, military strategy. And Duryodhana, he was satisfied with this because he had the big army. So he told him, Krishna said, you go to Duryodhana now, and you can get the boon that you asked for, because he now has the arrows that were destined to kill all of you, Pandavas. So he went to the camp, and he said to Duryodhana, Duryodhana said, yes, they were friends at night during the war. He said, please sit down. They would eat and joke and be friends. What do you want? And he said, I've come to see you. And he said, actually, you gave me a boon, and I could have anything I wanted. And he said, okay. He said, even if you want this kingdom, I'll give it to you without any fight. Just say the word and you've got the whole kingdom. He said, no, I don't want the kingdom without fighting. That wasn't the Kshatriya spirit. He said, but I want those five arrows that I know you have. So immediately, without any hesitation, he gave him the five arrows. So that was the end of the five arrows. Then when Duryodhana came to hear of this before the fighting, he was disturbed. And he said, now what are you going to do? You're the greatest fighter. You don't have your arrows. He said, all right, now I lost the arrows, but I'm going to show my prowess by, I'm going to kill Arjuna. No matter what happens, I'm going to fight so fiercely with all my strength, that no matter what happens, Arjuna will lose his life. So he did. He engaged in very, very fierce fighting. It was so fierce that Arjuna was beginning to lose the combat. And his chariot was broken, and he was on the ground, and Bhishma began to come at him with bows and arrows, and he was beginning to pierce the body of Arjuna with his arrows. At this point, we've seen this famous picture. Arjuna grabbed the chariot wheel and carried it on one finger like a disc and began to charge Bhishmadev. And I don't know if you ever saw that there's a film of the Mahabharata that's related to this scene where Arjuna is shooting at Bhishma. And